Pablo Vasquez is a prisoner in Texas. If the state has its way, he'll be dead within the hour. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world, where prison staff is preparing to put Vasquez to death by injecting him with a deliberate drug overdose. During the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will broadcast live coverage of the killing in Texas, the state responsible for nearly half of all executions in the U.S. Execution Watch host Ray Hill, chief legal analyst Jim Skelton, with legal analysts Larry Douglas, Jack Lee, Mike Gillespie, and Paige Yano. Huntsville reporter outside the death house, Pat Hartwell. Houston Vigil reporter, Jennifer Simmons. The execution watch for Pablo Vasquez begins.
Good evening, this is Ray Hill. The show is Execution Watch. You're listening to KPFT in Houston. You may have gotten here via our webpage, executionwatch.org. This is an audio-only show. Mr. Vasquez is scheduled to be interviewed, and Mark Pertle and I went up there to interview him and Robert Pruitt. Hey, Robert. When we got there, Robert came down chipper and in good spirits, and we interviewed him, but Mr. Vasquez did not leave the cell block, so we do not have an interview with Mr. Vasquez. In the course of the show, you're going to learn a lot. Mr. Vasquez's confession with the police authorities down in the valley is on the internet, and you can find it by searching his name, Pablo Vasquez, and it will pop right up. I found it very easily on the internet. Thank you, Jim, for giving
me a
heads up there. I would like to tell you that while we are doing Execution Watch, the regularly scheduled program for this time slot is Susan Darrow's Border Radio, which is a real avant-garde, hits-it-hard kind of radio that is certainly an alternative. And I can look through the glass over here on my left, and I can see Susan over there working her heart out using the microphones and the HD3 channel for those of you who have HD radio. But if you don't have HD radio, just get your internet-connected device and go to kpft.org, and among the choices you can have to listen to is HD3. Pat? Hello, Pat. Pat, are you there?
I am.
I can hear you now. Oh, by the way, Pat, a letter came for you in an envelope addressed to me. And I am at a quandary. Are you going to be in the studio this Friday?
Yes, I will.
Okay, well, I'll just leave.
Put Pat on it, and I'll pick it up.
I'll just leave it in the mailbox. I may take it home so that I can write him. And it's from Kyle Allen. Kyle, if you're listening, you see me and Pat connected up so she can get your letter. I always think about the guys are always listening to the show.
Yes, a lot of them do.
What's going on in Huntsville?
Well, the media witnesses crossed over, and then Pablo's witnesses crossed over with a few of the media from the Valley. He has, I believe, a cousin and a sister, and then, of course, the ardent anti-abolitionist Carl, who he calls Grandpa, who has visited him for 17 years, is witnessing tonight.
Okay. When, God, I hate trying to find words to articulate at the end of this process, when you call back to give us notice, call straight into the station, and if you've got Jeff up there, I'd like for him to join you at that time.
When I call back in, you want Jeff to join?
Yes, ma'am. We don't have an interview, so I'm going to have a little more time in this show to talk to Jeff.
Okay. And as we all know, once the witnesses cross, the Supreme Court, I understand, turned him down around 2 o'clock today, so there will be nothing else done. And he's already strapped to the gurney, and he will see the witnesses as soon as they get in, and he'll be able to make his last statement, and that's it.
Pat, I appreciate the work you do.
Okay, I'll call back.
Thank you, ma'am.
Uh-huh. Bye-bye.
And Jennifer. Hello, Jennifer. Oops, what happened? Jennifer, are you there?
Nope.
Nope, Jennifer is not there. I don't know what happened with that. I pushed the button as okay, that's what the problem was, is too many people pushing too many buttons. They'll hook them back up. Jim, this is not a pretty case.
It's a real bad case.
It happened, the case was tried in Edinburgh, Texas?
Yeah, down in the lower rear. Those are not familiar with Texas. It's at the very bottom of Texas. Brownsville is further south, and Edinburgh is right up the river from
Edinburgh, Harlingen, Laredo is all kind of down there.
And this occurred in Donna's, a little town between Edinburgh and Edinburgh and Mercedes, a little bitty town along the river. There's a whole bunch of little towns along the river.
Tell me about this case.
Well, what happened, Pablo Vasquez, 20-year-old kid, goes to a party with his 15-year-old cousin, Andy Garcia. And while at the party, and then supposedly there's some stuff about it being a gang party. And
hold on just a second. Let's get Jennifer in here. Okay, get Jennifer in. Jennifer?
Hi, Ray. I am here. Sorry to interrupt.
Yeah,
about 6 or 7 people here in front of St. Stephen's, corner of West Alabama and Woodhead. Our nuns from the Dominican Sisters community, of course, who are always supported. And we have a student here from U of H who is doing a research project on this issue, and she's here to find out as much as she can from us. Lots of positives today for some reason. The weather's beautiful, but lots of honks, thumbs up, waves. So that's good.
Well, the coalition is very active in the issue, and I'm glad you're getting some interest from students and other people to spread the word.
Right, right. And she is going to make sure she listens to your program when it's posted online later.
Yeah, it'll all be up tonight because we don't have a video here, so it's going straight to the web.
Right. And you know, we're not here to judge the heinousness of the crime. We're here to protest state-sanctioned killing in Texas.
And you're loyal and committed to that process, and
okay.
We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Give our regards to the other vigilants.
Okay. Bye,
Thank
Ray.
You, ma'am.
Good luck.
Yeah, Jim.
Well, as I said, Pablo is 20 years old, and his 15-year-old cousin go to this party, and supposedly it's a gang party. And there's alcohol, booze, cocaine, the typical stuff. And they ask him if he's a member of a gang. He said, that's not the way I roll. So he was not a member of any type of gang, insofar as the evidence showed. During the party, they met a 12-year-old kid named Davern Cardenas, or Cardenas, I think I pronounce it Cardenas, and all three of them left together at the party. And it doesn't have much information what occurred, but along the way, Vasquez hit this kiddo in the back of the head with a pipe. And pretty well, that was ended up being the fatal blow, according to the pathologist. And there were some more hitting with different objects. And during this process, Vasquez cuts the young man's throat, the 12-year-old kid's throat, hoists the body upon the shoulder. His shoulder begins to drink the kid's blood. As a matter of fact, he told the police that the devil made him do it. Part of him said, don't do it, and part of it, the devil was telling him to drink the blood. And said there was blood all over his face.
Well, was this a cult case?
Well, we think so. We've been disputing this, and it has all the earmarks of a cult because after they also, they mutilated the barred body, and they skinned the body, which normally is associated with cult killings. And they also tried to chop off the kiddo's head after he was dead, severed some of his limbs, and beat him where he was not recognizable. And the way the case was solved is about 4 or 5 days after they found the body, an informant called up the police and told them. And that's how they pick up this kid, and he gives a... Vasquez, amazing to everybody in the studio.
I listened to it 2 or 3
gave
times.
Gave a confession to the Donna Police Department, and they posted that confession, those who want to see it, on the Internet. And all you got to do is Google his name, and it'll come up immediately, and you can play the confession.
Yeah, any search engine will get you there.
Yeah, it'll get
it's pretty sensational stuff. Gets a lot of hits.
Yeah. And so, like I say, if you're interested in reading the confession, what I found interesting, of course you watched it too, Ray, you'll hear people talk about flat effect. When normally you talk about something hideous, you show some emotion. And this kiddo just kind of laid it out like he's talking about.
As cool as a cucumber.
Yeah. And that's called flat effect when you're a psychologist say that. Anyway, he confessed to the killings. And the big issue in this case is whether or not it's a robbery, murder, or cult killing. And that was one of the big issues. It wasn't an issue for a trial. It was an issue for all the lawyers at this table.
Any question about the admission of that?
Mike's going to cover that, okay. And I think, unfortunately, under our law, probably it's going to be held admissible. That was never an issue on appeal about the admissibility of the confession, nor was the issue on appeal that this was not a death penalty case, but rather a cult killing, which isn't in the statutes a death penalty case. And Mike,
does the age of the victim make this a death penalty? No, you get it's
no,
under
the age,
six.
It's age known as under the age wouldn't make it in this particular case. He's under 12.
Yeah.
And the way they pled it as a robbery murder, because during the course of this killing, they took a ring and a necklace that belonged to him. But again, that's going to be further discussed by Paige and
okay.
Jack Lee. Jack's going to cover that pretty well.
Okay. Well, this is, I've been to the Edinburgh courthouse. We tried one of the Eroy Brown trials down there. And you can read about that trial in Michael Berryhill's The Trials of Eroy Brown, which is a book that's out, and I suggest that you read it. It's a fascinating case where the convict killed the warden and the field major. And the field major was my first cousin. I worked with a defense crew, and we were able to convince 35 out of 36 jurors in three trials that Eroy was not guilty. Where do I go from here, Jack?
Jack's the next one, huh?
Jack, so you're going to tell me about it.
Yeah, so the issue, whether this is a capital case or not, really depends on sequence. if they were intending to rob Cardenas, and in the process they killed him, that makes it a capital murder. If, on the other hand, they killed him, that's just straight murder. And then, oh, by the way, he's got some rings and he's got some cash and he's got whatever. Oh, let's go ahead and take that too. That's just murder with a robber with a theft of a dead body. And that ends up not being a capital case. So it depends on how the prosecutor approaches this case. If they, you've effectively have a dead person. And are they going to look at it as, oh, well, this was a robbery, and the murder happened as a consequence of that robbery? If that's the case, they can seek the death penalty.
They comb the cat hair that fine?
Oh yeah, it may seem trivial, but the idea is that if somebody dies while you're trying to do something bad, as if murder weren't bad enough, then well, we're going to seek the death penalty. But if you just flat out kill somebody, no death penalty.
And I remember a famous Galveston case where there was some body mutilation. That very famous man got found guilty of mutilating the body, but not guilty of murder. That was an interesting case. Of course, it was probably a lot of money spent on legal representation.
You're talking about Robert Durst.
Yeah, the Robert Durst case. Yeah, that was...
Ray, the thing is, it's not that fine hair, really. You've got to have the purpose of the killing has got to do robbery. That's your primary purpose. But if you kill somebody, and you see this oftentimes when people go out in clubs and start drinking, go to someone's house and get into an argument and kill somebody.
Yeah.
And then they get panic and steal the guy's car. That is not a capital case because the purpose of the killing was not to steal the car. That was an afterthought after the killing took place.
Well, in actual practice, would the lawyers argue that issue?
That's what amazes me, and that's my only criticism of the lawyers in this case. It never came up at trial, so far as I can tell. It was never an appellate issue. It was never discussed. Unless they bring it up at trial, it never will be discussed. And we're the only ones that have kind of focused in on this. Nobody else has.
It's not in the appellate record at all.
No, it's not even a point of argument.
Yeah. And I think, in this case, it seems to me that this was a murder and that the theft was really an afterthought. Well, he's got a ring and he's got a necklace and it's not like he's going to take it with him. So let's go ahead and take it in.
But, of course, if you're actually in trial in Edinburgh, Texas, and you've got a jury in the panel, and they bring in this body mutilization stuff and all of that, that's not consistent with a robbery murder.
Well, you know, you could just have some people who are extremely depraved, and after they rob them, they decide to mutilate the body. That seems a little odd.
Yeah,
it seems to make more sense that, at least to me, it seems to make more sense that this was an occult killing.
Well, he certainly doesn't say anything in the confession that we set out to rob him and then killed him.
Remember what the Donna Police Department, all of them, thought it was a cult killing.
Yeah.
And they discussed it being a cult killing. It's when he hit the prosecutor's office, all of a sudden it became robbery murder. But up until then, virtually all the police said it was a cult killing. They thought it was a cult killing.
And I think the reason...
Well, apparently there's a lot of cult activity in
there. Now, Paige is going to do some research on that for us.
Okay, Paige. Tell us about Edinburgh, Texas and the surrounds.
Well, of course, it's right on the border. And as a result, there is one, heavily Catholic influence. Two... They have had a series of events ever since at least the 80s I was able to check up on that have involved cult issues, cult murders and bad things that are happening as a result of trying to bleed people and flay them and break bones. And because of this prevalent feeling in the border about not necessarily commitment to the Catholic Church, but a perverted sort of religion that involves the absolute murder and desecration of a corpse.
And Paige, more importantly, blood's a big part of that. Drinking blood is a big part of that.
That's in Christian rituals.
Well, of course it is. We have symbolic cannibalism with the Lord's Supper. We play like we eat God and drink Him. Yeah. And washed in the blood of the Lamb, that's a big part of religion, big part of the Catholic faith. But drinking blood is one of those rituals that most of those cults go through. In fact, the one that Paige is going to talk about, the reason they drank blood, they were drug dealers and thought by drinking blood, the cops couldn't see them. They were invisible.
Yes. In the Kilroy case,
right,
which is what Jim is referring to, there were about 15 murders involving people who had been captured or kidnapped and taken to a secluded location that had become the hideout and place of refuge and sanctuary for these cult members. And all of these bodies were discovered as a result of a drug dealer who is a participant in this cult. When he was crossing the border, he failed to stop, and so the police chased him, found 250 pounds of marijuana in his truck or in his car, and then got back to where he was from, went back to the homestead / sanctuary, and as a result, they discovered the existence of these 15 bodies.
Well, actually, I was called to McAllen to form a gay or lesbian organization a good many years ago, and I went down there, and the meeting was held in the police chief's house. His wife made cookies and coffee for us mm-hmm. for the meeting, and I couldn't understand why a gay organization had any hope of surviving without having some police fighting thing, but the deal was that they had had several really heinous crimes against gay people and transgendered people, particularly, that it was ritual elements of that. And that happened in McAllen, which is not really far from Edinburgh. So apparently that's going around in that culture.
Yes.
And what the police chief deal with, the police chief forming an organization, he wants some help solving the crime.
Well, yes, it's going around in that culture, but it's gone around for a long time.
I'm talking, this is back in the 80s.
Yes, but, you know, in ancient Greece,
yeah,
there were ritual murders in ancient Rome. In many different cultures, ritualism has been part and parcel of their worship.
But this was not an element of this case in the trial or in the appeal.
It was an element in the sense it enraged the jury. But as far as them pushing the cult part, they just did that to excite the jury, I think.
It was kind of like Kelly Stiegler killing the mantras.
Well, it was, as far as I could tell from reading the record, the lawyers pretty well ignored the cult part of the case. Mm-hmm. And they just talked about robbery murder throughout most of the trial.
Wait a minute. I may be missing something here. But without the sole explanation of the trial being robbery murder that justifies this as a capital case, and the lawyers didn't play that?
No. Not so far as I could tell. Normally, if that would have come, I talked to Jack. I think Jack has more to add to this. Had that come up, they could have gotten a lesser-included defense on straight murder. If they thought it was not done for the robbery but done for the cult part, they would have been entitled to a lesser-included defense on murder if the evidence showed that. There, as far as I can tell, there was no lesser-included defense of straight murder submitted to the jury. I think Jack explored that a little bit.
You know, I can't speculate as to why the defense didn't bring this up or didn't make that argument. If they didn't in fact do that, I think it's much easier to speculate why under prosecutorial discretion why they went first as a robbery and the murder being incidental to a robbery. I think this crime was so awful. You have chopped up limbs. You have a skinned body.
Oh, yeah, I understand the drama.
Of a 12-year-old boy. It's so revolting that the prosecutor said, this is so revolting, we want the death penalty. They sent it to the jury, and the jury said, you know, this is so revolting, we're going to give you the death penalty. And it's, you know, I see why the prosecution might have decided to go for robbery then murder, rather than murder then robbery. Because if you went with murder, this was a murder, and then the theft was incidental. You wouldn't have death penalty.
Anybody ever see the movie Boogie Nights?
Yes.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Excellent movie.
Remember that scene in the Boogie Nights where everything goes crazy in the dopey mm-hmm. house? You remember that?
Sure.
You know, you add the element of drugs and everybody's shooting at everybody. It's absolutely bizarre. That's the kind of image I get of this case.
Except that there doesn't seem to be any evidence that there was any drugs involved.
It was cocaine, apparently. One article I didn't put in the handout, Jack, it's not your fault. They had been using cocaine and marijuana. But the reason I don't think it's like Boogie Nights, there's only three people involved. Yeah. There wasn't a whole group going crazy. You're only talking about three people. And really what you're talking about is Vasquez. Garcia was kind of a tag-along, the best I can figure.
What happened to Garcia?
35-year sentence.
35-year sentence. Of course, he gave up some testimony.
He testified against.
Yeah, for that.
Yeah. Right.
That's the play, Let's Make a Deal.
Anyway, the elements that appear from the appellate record at trial on the state's version of events seem to have been that Chapa, who is the cousin, the 15-year-old cousin, Chapa says in testimony that Vasquez told him he killed the boy because the boy did not give him what he wanted. And so
Do you have any idea what that might have been?
No, we have no idea. But that might have been construed by the jury as the primary motive as opposed to a ritual.
I mean, that's kind of where you get to the robbery murder thing.
Yes.
But remember, he's also testifying to save his skin.
Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's what you do.
And let me tell you why I really think why it wasn't brought up at Make a Cult Deal. Because if you're seeking the death penalty, it's a robbery murder theory. If you talk a lot about the cult, it scares a hell out of people to think there's a cult going on and they want to kill somebody to get rid of that cult. I think the defense could very well have stayed away from that not realizing it didn't make a good defense, because that would be something that would make it more compelling to give him the death penalty if you believe in the robbery murder.
Okay, I need to talk to the folks out there in the audience. You're listening to Execution Watch on radio station KPFT in Houston. We go on the air every time there's an execution. What is happening right now today is Pablo Vasquez is being killed by the state of Texas. There are witnesses in there, some of them from the media and others from his family. And certainly the victim's family has a right to come in and witness. But the place is full. All the seats are taken. For us to do execution watch when it is appropriate to do that, and that is during an execution, we replace the regularly scheduled program. And the regularly scheduled program for this time slot on KPFT is Border Radio with Susan Darrow. And right through the mirrors over here, I can see Susan in there spinning records and doing her bit to bring you that. And that is all available to you on a KPFT HD3 channel for those of you in the new cars with the HD radios. If you're not there, you can get it on the Internet. KPFT.org, HD3 channel. You can listen to this program virtually forever because sometime later today it will be posted to our website, which is executionwatch.org. Who goes next, Larry or Mike? Jack, Mike.
I'm next, Ray.
Well, okay, Larry, what's cooking?
Well, the issue that I'm to talk about is the appeal claiming ineffective assistance of counsel. But before talking about that, just a couple of things. The way the prosecutor bootstrapped this into a death penalty case, I mean, that whole apparent evidence regarding a ritualistic killing, there's nothing in the law that allows for those kinds of killing to get a death sentence. So in order to get the death sentence, while that evidence is out there, that it might be an occult killing. An occult killing does not justify the death penalty, but a robbery does. And in the confession, which Mike's going to talk about later, Vasquez does talk about the fact that he took a ring and a necklace. I think he said he even threw them away, which means that they could not have been the motive. If he was going to take something, just throw it away. It just makes, and it happened after the fact, so there's no way that could have happened.
Well, let me get in the head of that prosecutor. All right, so you've got a series of cult-like killings going on in your jurisdiction. They're heinous. They're going to impress the jury beyond any means. You can get anything you want with that kind of drama. You're trying to send a message to other people that commit cult killings to stop doing that because it could mean that you go to death row. If people don't value their life, going to death row is not such a big deal. And people in cults are willing to sacrifice their lives for their deeply held causes. See, what bothers me most about this case is not only they're killing a young man who was stupid, bright, crazy, maybe certainly stoned and doing things that nobody should do, but moreover, who are we sending a message to that might perceive it and respond to it by sending him to death row for a case that under normal circumstances would not even make the criteria of being a death case?
Well, right. I can't necessarily get inside this prosecutor's head, but some prosecutors do go for, they overcharge people with much as they can. And so whether it's to send a message, if the prosecutor decides, the prosecutor pretty much has sole discretion on.
I think you guys are being kind. It's electability they're worried about.
Really? Is that what it
Absolutely.
Is?
Absolutely.
Absolutely. I know that the last time I got arrested, and by the way, I got one of those rough rides, but I'm too big, and with this peg leg, I was wedged in there like a tick. They couldn't hurt me with that stuff. But last time I got arrested, they had me charged with aggravated assault of a police officer, a felony offense. So I understand about overcharging.
You forget, Ray, when Durst got found not guilty, the DA was kicked out of office the next year, so it was obviously political.
So it does have political aftermath.
The whole law and order aspect certainly does motivate prosecutors to do a lot of what they do. But in terms of the ineffective assistance of counsel, which is pretty much a standard grounds for appeal.
That's what you kind of have to do, isn't it?
Well,
doesn't the appellate lawyer have to wet the pant leg of the trial lawyer?
That's just one of the tried and one of the triedness is not necessarily true, but it's oftentimes used to say that the trial counsel did something wrong, that his performance was substantially subpar. That's the first thing you got to show. And then, but for that subpar performance, the outcome would have been different. So it's a pretty tough burden to meet. And in this case, particularly on the issue that they raised two issues. One, the judge was sort of in and out of the courtroom for a while during the jury selection process, and judge has to be there to be able to determine.
Absolutely.
But there was no showing that the judge wasn't focused on what was going on. I think he went out and got some water or something for prospective jurors. And the other was there were 26 on the jury panel who were removed for cause based on their inability to follow the law as it applies to the imposition of death penalty. And so
that sounds like Catholic community.
Well, what happened was it's my understanding that, first of all, the questionnaires that went out that the jurors, prospective jurors, have to fill out, that these 26 had indicated that their views prohibited them from imposing the death penalty in any case. So while if they stuck with that position, then they would certainly be removed for cause. So the judge then asked them specific questions to determine whether they could consider the death penalty in an appropriate case. And they all indicated that they could not. Now, Vasquez's appellate lawyer said, well, what the defense lawyer should have done was to try to rehabilitate them, to carry them through the spectrum, saying, you know, in some cases, can you follow the law? And the law will never require that any juror say, I'm for the death penalty. You've just got to answer special issues in accordance with the law. And if you can follow the law and then you look at terrible cases that maybe the death penalty would be appropriate, well, terrible cases where the vote might be that the mitigation is not there. But the defense lawyer, according to Vasquez's appellate counsel, should have done was at a minimum he should have at least tried to rehabilitate the jurors who'd indicated that they could not follow the law. And his failure to do so, they consider to be not good performance, substandard performance. The other side of that is, okay, so he didn't try to rehabilitate the jurors. If he tried to rehabilitate them, maybe he could have rehabilitated them, maybe he couldn't. But what harm does it do? Can you demonstrate that his failure to do that, failure to try to rehabilitate, if he had done what you asked him to do, that is, at least try to rehabilitate, would the result have been different? Would it have been found guilty of murder? Would have been found not guilty? What difference would it have made? And typically in Strickland kind of cases and these kinds of ineffective assistance of counsel kinds of cases, they oftentimes fail on that note. If they don't fail on both, that is the substantially subpar performance, and but for that substantially subpar performance, the result would have been different. And you just never know. Because you don't know what's in the minds of jurors, because some jurors who feel like, I mean, I've had cases where a friend of mine said, no, she actually got on a jury, lied to get on, saying that this is a murder trial. She said, I got on with the specific intention of hanging this thing up. I know they were going to try to do this. They were going to find this guy guilty and probably send him to prison for a long time. So I wanted to hang it up. But once she started hearing the evidence, she had to admit, she said, I was one of the first to hang him.
Courtroom conversion.
And so you just never know what would have happened had the people that you thought should have been allowed to serve on the jury, had they been allowed to. But it's not just allowing to serve on the jury. Could they have been rehabilitated to the point where they would have answered the question, says, yes, I can be fair. And then who knows what would have happened in terms of striking them or using a peremptory challenge against them. But if you do rehabilitate someone, that is, if you convince them that they would be an appropriate juror in this case, you know, have you caused them to do harm to their conscience, or have you caused them to actually be dishonest? Maybe they were honest to begin with and said, I can't do it. And then you get on the jury and you find out, wait a minute, I said I could do this and I really can't, not without doing violence to my conscience. So it's a tough it's a two-edged sword.
Yeah, you folks down in the courthouse with your suits and ties on have a lot of things to worry about. Mike Gillespie?
There you go.
You got a client, and he sits down apparently an hour better with the detectives in his case, and there's a camera running, and you get this kind of confession. What the hell do you do?
Well, Miranda is a very interesting claim. I have found that of all the law my clients know, everybody knows Miranda. I hear so many people say, but they didn't give me Miranda for that DWI. They didn't give me Miranda for that traffic ticket. Everybody knows Miranda. I've gone to see clients in jail as a lawyer, and they say, I'm not going to talk to you because of Miranda.
Your clients.
Yeah. Well, that's unique. But what's not unique is when you send pretrial services to make a pretrial bond, they won't talk to pretrial because they have the right to remain silent.
Yeah.
Everybody knows this. Sometimes I think people tend to think if they're honest, they can get away with something. In this case, they sit him in a place that looks like a living room. He's not handcuffed. He's not in uniform. Everybody's sitting around talking. Now, what we need to talk about is waiving rights. They read him the waiver. They read him the proper waiver. But the question is, did he waive it? They didn't say, do you waive your rights? They said, you want to give a statement. I didn't hear him waiving his rights. He gave a statement. Even if a man says to the police, I want to give a statement, they got to give you your rights, and you have to waive having a lawyer before you get it. Now, the appellate court will basically say he understood what he was doing by the total circumstances of the words. In addition to that, they had all the rights written down, and they had him signed it, they had him initial it, so therefore he got his rights. But there's no education the kid could read. There's no indication if the rights are in Spanish or English. He seemed to read, to sound like he could speak English. Doesn't mean he could read English. Nobody knows. Rights are so important. They need to be clearly waived. These were not clearly waived. They went through the motions of saying you have rights. I don't believe he waived them. I think the confession was very damaging. I also want to talk about this cult situation. I got a question. I don't understand. Wouldn't it have been better to charge it as a murder as a cult rather than a death penalty? And what I'm getting at, if you stretch the law and they have a problem in that part of the world with cult and cult activities, as we've read, wouldn't you want to get rid of the source of the cult rather than one individual person? If the cult is doing this, why take this one boy and put him in prison and execute him when you have all these other people out there believing the same situation? My question is, and to you specifically, Jim, is this a conspiracy? Could everybody in that cult be arrested for a conspiracy to commit murder because they got together with a joint plan to make sacrifices, and he didn't act in furtherance of the conspiracy?
Jim, don't be immediately responsive. We've got a call from Huntsville. I think this procedure is over. You're on the air. Pat?
Ray, it's Jeff.
Jeff, okay.
The witnesses just walked across.
Okay, so the procedure is over, and I can tell my audience that Pablo Vasquez is now dead. He's killed by intravenous poisoning by the state of Texas. Your commentary.
Oh, man, another lie. Another, we keep telling people that if we keep doing these procedures, then, we're going to, I guess give us some punishment for crime and all these types of things. We're going to stop killing. We're going to do all these things. And, again, it's just another lie. And it's just every time I stand out here, I look up at that cross that's, on top of the walls unit. And we're once again reminded that Texans think that they have to have blood when evil occurs, and it's a lie.
Well, Jeff, by the way, how are your interviews with the Dallas Observer going?
Oh, it's great. That's great. I've had, ever since the arrest, been a lot of positive news coverage in North Texas, and, we're just continuing to get the word out in North Texas. I mean, North Texas is a long way away from Huntsville, and we're just trying to, keep people engaged with what's going on.
Well, the last time you were on Execution Watch, you were on your way to a paddy wagon, and that became resolute, right?
It did. I was there for a little over 7 hours, and I had a lot of time to think and to pray and whatnot. And, I still remained as resolute, as determined as ever, that this has to stop. And people of faith have a particular responsibility to make it stop. I think people of faith, and particularly Christians, are the reason for this in the first place.
Well, they may not all be like Christians, but the lawyers in this room have come to a conclusion that this case was excessively filed as a capital case when perhaps it should not have been, that the robbery murder aspect was an exaggeration, to put it mildly. But they decided that it was motivated by the next election.
Well, I would imagine there are many of them that are exactly like that.
Jeff, I appreciate you being on Execution Watch. Keep the good story. Now, when you go to trial, give us a report from that.
I will. That'll be in May, and I will certainly give you all a report. Thank you for all y'all do.
Thank you, Jeff.
Bye-bye.
That is Jeff Wood. He is obviously a Baptist preacher who drives a Cadillac, and I think that's a requirement to be a Baptist preacher who drives a Cadillac. And he is tries to make Huntsville for every execution, and the last time he went, he crossed the line and went to jail for the statement that it made. Now, you still remember Mike's
Before
question?
Before I answer Mike's question, let me explain something carefully. There's a difference between, we got two sets of rights. One of them's Miranda. The other one's statutory 3822. Anytime you have a confession, always go to 3822. The reason being, Miranda does not require a waiver of rights. 3822 does. So there's a big distinction between the two.
Now, 3822 is a Texas statute.
That's right. There's a 3822 statute, Code of Criminal Procedure. It requires a waiver. Miranda does not require a waiver of those rights. That's statutory. So anytime you're looking at a confession, always go to 3822. It has everything Miranda has plus some. It's Miranda supercharged. And now, as far as the conspiracy part, under federal law, perhaps, they're pretty wide about conspiracy. Under state law, it's three or more people gathering together to commit an unlawful act, and somebody commit a, they agree to do an act together, and somebody commits an overt act. It's usually offense specific. So to have a conspiracy, your conspiracy in this case would be the kid, the 12-year-old kid, I mean the 15-year-old kid, and the defendant who's 20 years old. Now, if there are other people that helped them plan it, help them do the murder, they could be charged with a conspiracy too if they agreed to help do this. But it's usually offense specific. You couldn't get all the cult unless you can prove that cult. For example, a good example is the cases up in Waco. They're going to have a difficult time proving any type of organized criminal activity because they've got to prove all of them had some sort of an agreement. And that's going to be almost impossible to prove.
Yeah, I'm a consultant in that case, so I'm under a gag order.
It's just if the act he did so upset the DA's office to escalate it from murder to capital murder, I could see them escalating the conspiracy statute to get a lot of publicity, get all these people in jail, get them to trial. Good for the re-election.
Yeah, Mike, you've got to talk into the mic. Larry, any reflection on this?
Well, my feeling is that the prosecutors tend to be focused on one case at a time, typically. And in this case, the concern is, how do I get this guy dead? How do I kill him? And you can't kill him for being a member of a cult, engaging in cult activity.
You've got to make it robbery, murder.
You've got to do
in that order.
It's got to be under this set of circumstances. There are others, you know, several murders in the same episode. But in this case, the only way for him to do it, and they sort of got it from his confession, because he does admit to taking to committing a robbery, but the admission was the robbery occurred afterwards. So then they've got to get the co-defendant to come up with some sort of basis for justifying, for claiming that the robbery, the motive to rob, occurred before the killing, and that gets him dead.
Do they train these snitch witnesses, co-defendant witnesses? Are they trained? Are they allowed?
It's called woodshedding.
Well, woodshedding. Do they woodshed them to the point that
Absolutely.
They put words in their head?
Are you kidding? Of course they do. All, even defense lawyers, it's not prosecutors. Defense lawyers do the same thing. And we all woodshed clients. I mean, that's part of the game that they brought.
You've got to know what's going to happen before it happens.
Well, a good classic example of woodshedding is identity problems. Because if someone, they're having some question about identity being wrong, the lineup being wrong, all the prosecutor has to say to the witness, look, if we're going to have a hearing, and at this hearing the issue is going to be whether or not what your in-court identification is based on. If it's based on what happened at the lineup, this man who's killed 5 nuns and barbecued them will go free. But if it's based on the fact that you'll never forget what happened, the offense occurred, he's going to be convicted. Now, which is it?
Okay.
That's how you
would say. You got to train them.
On your question of training, though, Ray, if the audience
I had a meeting with the police chief today. We talked about training cops to lie under oath. They have a program for that. They spend money teaching cops to lie under oath.
But in this case, the real critical training I see is if the audience goes and listens and watches the video of the confession, the training to cause a person to hear those words, you have the right to remain silent, those warnings. And then after having heard and understood and initialed and signed, they then go ahead and talk. To train the persons taking the confessions are very calm, and their training is to elicit the.
Do you want to talk? Sponge up the information
and just let them talk. And they did a good job. If you watch that, because people for whatever reason think they convince them, if I just talk, it's gonna be all right. And they get their confidence and a really. Almost deceptive way, but it's not. It's just convincing them that you're okay. You're in a good setting. Go ahead and talk to me. It's just between me and you.
There's a wonderful movie about that. It included Brandon Dowell. I remember his name because he was the handsome one. That's not the detective, but Brandon was called The Confessions about a couple of kids that had decided to commit suicide, but the detective got a full confession from the guy who survived, and his girlfriend didn't. And then after he got the confession, they found the suicide note, which has apparently been written before the incident occurred. And so that all of that activity of getting a confession was valueless. Go to your movie search thing, you'll find it. The Confession with Brandon Dubois. So it makes good theater. It also makes stuff that happens around the courthouse.
Yep.
That's pretty regular stuff.
It's more regular than people actually realize.
And Mike mentioned earlier, Ray, regarding people have heard about the warnings, but they just don't understand them. And so that's why, although they've all heard about it, but they don't understand what it means, because that shows how they so grossly misapply it. And I think it's important for us as lawyers to try to get the word out, to tell your clients, just don't start talking to them, because when you start talking, you're going to lose. They suck you into this game where you think you're going to win, but you're always going to lose. And very
no matter what you say, you lose.
No matter what you say, you're going to lose. But and certainly in a case where there's somebody's been killed,
yeah,
and they are talking to you about the circumstances surrounding the death, But people who haven't done anything, that's even worse. If you haven't done what they claim they're talking to you about, because sometimes they will start to talk to you about things. They claim to talk to you about one thing, and they're really talking to you about something totally different. They know, you don't, so the best thing to do is just not to say anything other than, I think I need to have a lawyer.
Yeah, lawyers are useful things. Chuck Rosenthal's a lawyer, and he commented on the Anthony Graves case that it's a lot easier to convict somebody that doesn't know anything about the case at all. It's just completely oblivious to what happened because they don't even know when we get the facts wrong and they can't respond to that.
Right.
Pretty scary stuff when you think about it. I want to take a few minutes here to talk to the audience a little bit. This is this case. We've pretty well covered it. Anybody else? Any other comment anybody needs to make?
One comment.
Okay.
Conspiracy. Based on what Jim said, I understand DAs know how to skirt the law, but if they're really training their police officers to lie under oath, isn't that a conspiracy to commit aggravated perjury?
That's true, and I brought that up with Acting Police Chief Montalvo today. I said, in your budget, there is a program to teach officers how to do undercover stings, and I have hacked into their website and taken that training. And that training basically says you always want to testify from the bench, including all of the elements of the offense. What's not in that tape is tell the truth of what you saw and heard. It is testify so that it includes all the elements of it. If that's not training people to lie under oath, I don't know what it is. I think that program will probably be defunded. She's looking for some place to cut the budget right now, and that's a weak time to talk to her about a thing like that.
Maybe they can cut the budget on the police video room the grand jurors look at to justify police shootings before they take indictments.
Yeah, maybe so. My name is Ray Hill, and the name of the program is Execution Watch, and we do this show every time somebody gets executed. Very soon you will be able to go to our website and meet these lawyers in a more open session. We got into a roundtable discussion the other day, and I threw out a straw case and just completely blindsided Larry because I made him a lawyer, defense lawyer, in a case that he didn't have all the facts, and he was anguishing over that. But that film shows the legal staff on Execution Watch actually thinking and anguishing about how to defend one of two defendants and how to prosecute them. We cover the whole thing. We do it absolutely right. And it is such an honor for me to work for these people. I know once in a while one of them will say something, it'll set somebody off, and I'll get a letter from death row. Yeah. I get a lot of letters that I've been in. I take them all very seriously. If they're constructive, I will apply them, try to make the show better. But if it's just ragging on the people who volunteer their time and spend a great deal of time and energy researching these cases and prepare these cases without getting paid a dime, a lawyer charges for his experience and the time that he or she puts into a case. And they're entitled to every penny that they make, and most of them are working a lot of them on court-appointed cases, and others are being kind of underpaid for the quality of the work that they do. But these guys and gal who volunteer their time to come to the prison show and work, it's a real honor to work with them. They're all, each in their own way, brilliant. They're all different personalities, and it's my job to put that puzzle together so that it paints a picture of the serious business that is going on while we're on the air. There is no Pablo Vasquez. He was killed by the state of Texas by intravenous poisoning. It took him over 30 minutes of being poisoned to actually die. This program began by saying he's on the gurney, Pat reported, strapped down, needles in his arm. And the witnesses crossed the road, and there was no stopping it. It was a ritual that is as ancient as the execution of anything going back to the ritual killings of the Aztecs and the Egyptians and, well, just all the way back. We do that still. It's an anachronism. The people who are trying to bring you information about these cases is directed by Elizabeth Stein. She is our producer. She tells us what to do, and we try to do that. Bob Gardner has done the engineering tonight. Thank you, Bob. I appreciate that. Otis McClay is the magician that will put this on the website so that you will be able to listen to it in perpetuity. Everything we do has been placed on that website. If there's a video, you get that. If there's just an audio, you get that. It's all there. Pat Hartwell, on the scene reporter from Huntsville, Texas. Jennifer Simmons, on the scene reporter from the demonstration here in Houston over at St. Stephen's Church of those opposed to executions right here in Houston. There were other demonstrations around the state. We didn't cover it, but it's there. The legal team. Jim Skelton is lead bro, for those of you who have been to prison. On that, he leads the gang out there, and he does the research, passes it around. Larry Douglas, Michael Gillespie, Jack Lee, and, of course, our freshman class, Paige Yannick, is in here doing her things. I do not like doing this show. But I think there is an obligation to do this show. And, Robert, I think you got the wrong tape on because I can hear Larry talking in the background. I just need the music to end the show. The music, by the way, is Victoria Panetti. Was her brother executed? He got a last-minute stay, I think. The Panetti story. Elizabeth? Victoria Panetti's brother was not executed, was he? You got a last minute, so I don't remember her doing shit.
He wasn't.
He was not. Okay. And so she's with us in the music, and if you run into her in the visit room in Death Row, she looks like a different kind of character. She's a punk rock singer that takes full advantage of her freedom. My name is Ray Hill. This is Execution Watch. I am sorry we have sad news to report tonight. Pablo Vasquez is dead. Good night.
Put something on. Anything. Sound.
You know what's sad, Will? You get to be almost routine.
That's why I do these editorials, is to keep it from being routine. I just want to do these editorials, is trying to break it up a little bit.
So sad.
You guys do such a wonderful job.
Well.
Don't you know they're killing people?